I wonder whether you're concerned about the ubiquity of devices in modern life and what they do to your attention span. Phones and tablets and laptops seem to be in everyone's hands most of the time. Now, I'm probably one of those people who look around at others at work in the street anywhere and notice how they all seem to be head down, intently focused on a small screen, usually a smartphone. And I wonder, can this be a good thing across the board? Shouldn't people be noticing the world around them, talking and interrelating with the people they're with? Of course, it can be very annoying. We've all been at dinner with someone who is totally distracted by their phone. In a meeting, educators in classroom settings drives them mad. Even in mid-conversation with someone, if you had this, I mean, this is commonplace now, isn't it? You can be in mid-conversation with someone, their phone will ring and they think it's okay to look at the phone and see who's there. In fact, you'd be regarded as rude, I think, if you objected these days. Is this a good development either? Your thoughts on this, 1300 800 222, text 0467 922 702. You might have someone close to you can't tear themselves away from a screen or a smartphone or tablet. Or perhaps your children's use of devices is bothering you too, because you, like many parents, have tried to limit screen time. How successful has that been in your house, I wonder? Usually it's met with anger, abuse, and even physical confrontation. British author and journalist Johan Hari's studied the phenomenon that he describes as the theft of focus. And in his latest book, released early this year, titled Stolen Focus, Why You Can't Pay Attention, he argues there's a range of reasons that steal our focus, not just technology, but factors like lack of sleep, our lives, work expectations, and even our ability to pay attention. He's a best-selling author, writer of non-fiction, a highly successful TED Talk speaker too, who's written on many other topics, including the topic of depression and the war on drugs. He's currently in Australia. It'll be on Q&A tomorrow night, but he's here with us now to talk about attention spans and technology. Johan, good evening. Welcome to Nightline.
Hey, Philip. I always like doing late-night shows because I think the biggest division between human beings is not left-wing versus right-wing or atheists versus religious people. It's morning people versus night people. And I am so deeply a night person. I feel like your listeners are my tribe. So this is early in the night as far as I'm concerned.
It's very early in the night. Yes. Well, welcome to Nightlife. You're going right across the country. Can you describe how a young relative made you aware of the theft of focus you see all around us in the modern world? You were on a trip to Elvis's Graceland.
Yeah, I've got a godson, and when he was nine, he developed this brief but very intense obsession with Elvis Presley, and it was particularly cute because he seemed to genuinely not know that impersonating Elvis had become a kind of cheesy cliche. So I think he was the last person in the history of the world to do a totally sincere impression of Elvis. And when I used to tuck him in at night, it would get me to tell him the story of Elvis's life over and over again. Obviously, I skipped over the bit where Elvis died on the toilet. And one night I mentioned Graceland, where Elvis lived. And he looked at me and he said, Johan, will you take me to Graceland one day? Yeah. And I said, sure, the way you do with nine-year-olds. No, next week it'll be like Lapland or whatever. And he looked at me really intensely. He said, no, do you swear one day you'll take me to Graceland? And I said, I absolutely promise. And I didn't think about that again for 10 years until so many things had gone wrong. So he dropped out of school when he was 15. And by the time he was 19, he spent literally almost all his waking hours alternating between his laptop, his iPhone, his iPad. And his life was just this kind of blur of WhatsApp, YouTube, pornography. And it almost felt like he was kind of whirring at the speed of Snapchat, when nothing still or serious could touch him. And one day we were sitting on my sofa in London, and I've been trying to get a conversation going with him all day, and I just couldn't. And he's a really intelligent, nice person. I just couldn't get any traction with him. And to be totally honest with you, Philip, I wasn't that much better, right? I was staring at my own devices. And I suddenly remembered this moment all these years before. And I said to him, hey, let's go to Graceland. And he looked at me completely blankly. He didn't remember this, but I reminded him. And I said, you know, we've got to break this numbing routine. This is no way to live. Let's go on a journey all over the South. But I thought ahead and I said, you've got to promise one thing if we do this, which is that if we go, you'll leave your phone in the hotel during the day, because there's no point going if you're just going to stare at your phone the whole time. And he thought about it and he said, yeah, I really want to do this. And I think it was maybe three weeks later, we took off from London to New Orleans, where we went first. And a couple of weeks after that, we got to the gates of Graceland. And when you go there now, this is even before COVID, there's no person to show you around. What happens is they hand you an iPad and you put in earbuds and the iPad shows you around. It says, go left, go right. Everywhere you go, it tells you a story about where you are. And everywhere you go, there's a picture of that room on the iPad in front of you. So what happens as we're walking around, I'm realizing everyone's just staring, walking around Graceland, staring at their iPads, right? Occasionally they would look up to take out their phones, take a selfie and then put it away and they go back to looking at the iPad. So we got to the jungle room, Elvis's favorite room in Graceland, full of fake plants. And I'll never forget it. There was a middle-aged Canadian couple next to us and the husband turned to his wife and he said, honey, this is amazing. Look, if you swipe left, you can see the jungle room to the left. And if you swipe right, you can see the jungle room to the right. And I thought he was kidding. I laughed. And I turned and looked. And him and his wife were just swiping back and forward. And I leaned over and I said, but hey, sir, there's an old-fashioned form of swiping you could do. It's called turning your head because...
It's called looking.
We're actually in the jungle room. You don't need to look at it on the internet. It's all around you. And they looked at me like I was completely deranged and backed out the room. And I turned to my godson to laugh about it. And he was standing in the corner staring at Snapchat because from the minute we landed... He just couldn't stop. And I went up to him. I did that thing that's never good with teenagers. I tried to grab the phone out of his hand and I said, look, I know you're afraid of missing out, but this is guaranteeing that you'll miss out.
Mm.
You're not present at your own life. You're not showing up at the events of your own existence. And he stormed off and I wandered around Memphis on my own the rest of the day. And that night I found him in the Heartbreak Hotel, which is up the street where we were staying. And he was sitting by the Guitar Shake swimming pool and he was looking at his Snapchat. And I went up to him and I apologized and I said, look, I'm sorry, I got so angry. And he didn't look up, but he said, I know something's really wrong and I don't know what it is.
Mm.
And I realized we kind of went away in order to get away from all these distractions, but it felt like there was nowhere to escape to. You know, the average office worker now focuses on any one task for only 3 minutes. For every one kid who was identified with serious attention problems when I was 7 years old, there's now 100 children identified with that problem. So I was like, okay, I need to really investigate what is happening to our attention and most crucially, how do we get it back?
Mm. What's the problem here? I mean, let's define attention and focus. I mean, what's different now to, say, 50 years ago when there was no internet or mobile phone or laptop computer? I mean, why have things changed? So, simply because the world is busier, why is that necessarily a bad thing?
It's not necessarily a bad thing, and there's lots of changes that have happened that are really positive and lots of aspects of our technology that are really positive.
Mm.
To try to understand this, I ended up going on this big journey all over the world from Miami to Moscow to Melbourne, not just to cities that began with the letter M. I don't know why I keep doing that. And I interviewed over 200 of the leading experts in the world on attention and focus and really dug deeply into their science. And what I learned is there's scientific evidence for 12 factors that can make your attention better or can make it worse. And loads of the factors that can make your attention worse have been hugely rising in recent years. They include some aspects of our tech, but go way beyond them. The food we eat, to give one of them, is profoundly harming our attention. But to go to that thing you've asked, right? So why is it a bad thing if we can't...
I mean, what's necessarily bad about it? Because that's right. We can't just say attention and focus are inherent... Of course, they're inherent goods. They're inherent goods. It's good to pay attention and good to focus on things because you can't really achieve without those skills. The fact that people can pay attention to many things at once now and focus on more than one thing at once is just a byproduct of modern life. Maybe that's a good thing.
So there's two bits of what you just said. First bit I think is totally right. I would say to anyone listening, think about anything you've ever achieved in your life that you're proud of, whether it's starting a business, being a good parent, learning to play the guitar, whatever it is. That thing that you're proud of required a huge amount of sustained focus and attention, right?
Mm.
Focus is essential for all human achievement. And when your ability to focus and pay attention breaks down, there's lots of evidence, your ability to achieve your goals breaks down, your ability to solve your problems breaks down, you feel worse about yourself because you actually are less competent. And the other way around, when you start to get your attention back, you feel better about yourself. So the first bit I think is right, that's why attention is so important. The second bit you said is something I thought for a long time, which is, oh, well, it's not that attention's got worse, it's just changed, right? Now, excuse me, we pay attention to many things. So I went to interview one of the leading neuroscientists in the world, an amazing man named Professor Earl Miller, who's at MIT in the United States. And he said to me, look, there's one thing you've got to understand about the human brain more than anything else. you can only consciously think about one or two things at a time. That's it. This is a fundamental limitation of the human brain.
When you say think about, that's not so. I mean, a race car driver, for example, is thinking about 100 things at once he or she's approaching a corner.
It's funny you mention race car drivers, because driving is actually one of the areas where this has been best studied. Mm. So what happens is scientists get people into labs, like Professor Miller, scientists all over the world, and they get them to think they're doing more than one thing at a time, right? Mm-hmm. And what they discover is you're not doing more than one thing at a time. What you're doing is you're juggling super quickly between tasks. You're like, wait, what did Philip just ask me? What's that message on WhatsApp there? What does it say Scott Morrison did on the TV? What's this message on Facebook? Wait, sorry, Philip, what was your question again? Hmm. So you're juggling super, super quickly. And that's useful in lots of situations. If you're a racing car driver, it's really important to do that juggling. But the evidence shows very clearly that it comes with a really big cost. The more things you're trying to do, the less competently you will do any of those things. So you'll remember less of what you do. You'll make far more mistakes. You'll be much less creative. And that sounds like a small effect when you first hear it, right? Okay, I get it. Juggling it maybe diminishes things. I'll give you an example of a small study that's backed by a wider body of evidence. Hewlett-Packard, the printer company, they got a scientist in to study their workers. And he split them into two groups. And the first group was told, just get on with your task, whatever it is. Just do that one thing and you're not going to be interrupted. And the second group was told, get on with your task, whatever it is. But at the same time, you've got to answer a heavy load of email and phone calls. So pretty much how most of us live. And at the end of it, he tested the IQ of both groups. The group that had not been interrupted scored on average 10 IQ points higher than the group that had. To give you a sense how big that is, if you or me smoked a fat spliff together now and got stoned, our IQs would go down in the short term by 5 points. So in the short term, it's twice as bad for your intelligence as getting stoned, right? You'd be better off sitting at your desk, doing one thing at a time and getting stoned than you would sitting at your desk, being constantly interrupted and not getting stoned. Now, to be clear, in case anyone's misunderstanding me, obviously you're better off not getting stoned either. But this is why Professor Miller said, we're living in a perfect storm of cognitive degradation as a result of being constantly interrupted. You mentioned driving. Actually, this is one of the areas where it's best studied. People like Professor David Shaler at the University of Utah, interruptions and distractions when driving massively increase the number of accidents you get involved in. So the more things you're trying to do when you drive, the more likely you are to crash.
Is the mobile phone the culprit here? Because that's what's changed the world, hasn't it? You and I are very lucky people because we were there when it wasn't here, and we've been here since it's arrived. I mean, the iPhone arrives in 2010.
Seems incredible.
It seems extraordinary that it's only 12 years old, but it is.
Yeah.
And it seems to us that it's been here forever. It hasn't been. Mary's just texted in saying, what were you talking about, Phil? I was concentrating on my device. That's right. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Is the mobile phone, therefore, because prior to that, there were computers and PCs and all of that, and there was television. So there were they were the screens, not so much laptops, perhaps. But the mobile phone changed. Well, not the mobile phone, the iPhone. And, you know, now it's imitators and et cetera, the Android systems and blah, blah, blah. But the iPhone itself all of a sudden changed everything, didn't it? Is it the main culprit?
It's a significant factor, but actually I was surprised it's not the biggest, although it is a really significant factor. So when I started working on my book, Stolen Focus, that's the story I had. I basically had two stories in my head about why my own attention had been getting worse for a while, which is... I thought, well, you're weak. There's something wrong with you. Why aren't you strong enough to resist this? And I thought, someone invented the smartphone and that screwed me over, right? Damn Steve Jobs and all those people. So at that time, this is before I went on this big journey and interviewed all these scientists, I thought, well, the solution here is obvious, right? If the problem is I don't have enough willpower and I'm exposed to a phone, I'll use my willpower and separate myself from my phone. So I was in the lucky position, one of my books got made into a movie, so I had some money for the first time in my life. So I decided I booked a room in a place called Provincetown in Cape Cod. It's a bit like Byron Bay. And I went there for 3 months and I had no phone that could get online and I had no laptop. And there were some ups and downs we can talk about, but I was amazed by how much my attention came back. I mean, I could focus as well as I had when I had been 16. I could read all day. I could have really long conversations. I was amazed by how quickly and how fully it came back.
Because I want you to define that for me. Let's just return to that. So attention and focus. What does attention mean? I mean, what does focus mean? Is it I mean, people still read books. They read books in large numbers, but reading hasn't declined. It's in fact, you know, it's continued to be strong.
Well, reading is slightly ticked up under COVID, but reading is enormously declined. Reading books for pleasure is enormously declined. In fact, this is the 2016 was the first year in the history of the United States when, in a given year, a majority of Americans didn't read a book for pleasure. So it's been a huge. I mean, it has got slightly better under COVID. That's true, and there is still a lot of people who do it. Mm. So, but it's a really interesting and important question. Something I explored a lot. So, what is attention? So, attention is generally defined as your ability to selectively attend to something in your environment, which sounds a bit fancy, but think about the room we're in now, right? So I'm looking at you, but I could be looking at the reflection of the control room behind me. I could, Lachlan, your producer's there. There's loads of things in this room I could be looking at. I can hear a slight buzzing sound. My phone is over there. I'm not looking at that. I'm filtering out all of that, and I'm narrowing my focus down to you, right? Mm. Filtering all that, I'm like, oh, okay, what's Philip asking me? So that's generally how attention is thought of. But actually, interestingly, there's a slightly more complex way of understanding attention that was explained to me by an amazing man named Dr. James Williams. He used to be at the heart of Google, and he was really horrified by what they were doing to people's attention. We can talk about why. And he had a real breaking point where one day he was at a tech conference, and the audience were literally people designing stuff, anyone listening, the stuff that your kids are using today, right? And that likely you are. Mm. And he said to them, if there's anyone here who wants to live in the world that we're creating, please put up your hand. And nobody put up their hand. Mm. He quit being in the tech world and he became, I would argue, the greatest philosopher of attention in the world right now. And he said, so actually there's three kinds of attention. I'd argue there's a fourth kind. So I'll just quickly tell you them. That the first one is what he calls your spotlight. So your spotlight is your ability to filter out all the other stuff in your life and do one short-term action. So let's say, you know, we have a break and I go to the fridge to get a Diet Coke. Mm. And on the way there, I get a text from my friend. I read it. I get happy or pissed off or whatever. And I forget why I went there and I come back and I don't have my Diet Coke, right? A lot of us will be experiencing those low-level disruptions to our spotlight. So that's the kind of most obvious form of attention disruption that we're experiencing. There's a level above that, which he calls your starlight. And that's your ability not to do a short-term thing like go and get a Coke from the fridge, but your ability to achieve a long-term goal like, you know, I want to paint this canvas, I want to write this chapter, I want to, you know, I want to make this garden, whatever it might be, right? And he argues, it's called your starlight because when you're lost in the desert and you don't have GPS, you look to the stars and you're like, oh yeah, that's the direction I was traveling in, right? And he argues, our starlight is being disrupted. Our ability not just to achieve short-term goals, but long-term goals is being screwed with.
Right. Johan Hari's with us. We're talking about focus and his book, which has sold a lot, examines why there is a worldwide deficit in focus and attention. The book's called Stolen Focus. Caroline from East Melbourne has raised a point which we probably should have raised at the beginning. Johan, I'm sure you want to put your hand on your heart here and say too that that you have in the past had a run-in with journalistic and literary malfeasance, but you've acknowledged that. And
15 years ago I presented some quotes that were said to other journalists as if they were said to me, which was a terrible thing to do. So with all my books since, I just put the audio in full on the website so people can hear it being said directly to me.
Exactly. Michael Carr-Grigg's a child and adolescent psychologist, by the way, and he's been big too on this issue of the use of phones. Michael, good evening to you.
Good evening to you.
What are you making of Johan's arguments about focus and attention?
I think he's spot on. And you only have to see what happens in, use for example, a Sydney high school that decided to follow the recommendations of the report that I wrote for the New South Wales government. And they banned mobile phones from first bell to last, including recess and lunchtime. And guess what? They saw a dramatic decrease in behavioural issues, a boost in physical activities, and students began to talk to each other after just 2 months. And there was an increase in academic performance. Everything that Johan predicted came true.
That's right. There's been news recently, haven't there, how quite a number of schools, private and public, have been locking phones up or banning them from the classroom, etc. The world hasn't ended. Do you? Is this the best response we've got, though, Michael? Do you think, or is there a more sophisticated one that's required?
Look, I think it's much more nuanced than that. If teachers in those schools require their students to use mobile phones for a specific purpose, a specific lesson, they're allowed to do that. But outside of those instructional episodes, there is mobile, they've got laptops, they've got Chromebooks, they've got a whole range of other ways to access brilliant educational material. They don't need mobile phones, which carry, of course, social media feeds. And I'm not a fan of social media in young people. And I think that what we can do at least is create an island in time when they can just focus on their work. And it's interesting because the West Australian government, the Victorian government and the Tasmanian government all embraced the concept behind the report, except the very state that commissioned it. Who knew?
Is it like though? Johan, join this conversation with Michael as well. But is this like though? Just standing at the water's edge and trying to hold it back?
No,
I mean even acknowledging the problem we've got here with mobile phone use with kids is that an appropriate response to saying you can't use them?
I think Michael's spot on, and this is why in France they've completely banned mobile phones at all schools. I went to schools like in Berkeley in California where they banned them, and exactly as Michael says, there's been these incredible improvements in their test scores, in behaviour, in kids' happiness. And so I think what we can do, there's all sorts of things we've got to do. I think this is one crucial plank. We can give our kids a big chunk of their lives where they get eye contact, where they learn social skills, all of those things. They're not going to suffer for lack of technology. They're going to have that the rest of the time. This is actually happening all over the world. China has just made huge moves to restrict young people's access to technology. It's not worth having a terrible communist dictatorship to do it. But you can see, because they're seeing those harms as well. So I think Michael is bang on. Giving them a good chunk of time where they can do that is so important.
How do you select out, though, Michael? Because the whole data revolution, of course, and the screen revolution has brought enormous benefits, hasn't it? How do you select out what's useful and what's not?
So one of the things that I specialise in is using technology for the well-being of young people. So I run workshops called Is That a Psychologist in Your Pocket? Talking about various different apps which can make a huge difference to well-being. There are apps now that we can use to help kids with self-harm, with suicide, suicidal ideation. We've got them to help them with mindfulness. So there's a bevy of wonderful uses, which I think Johan was hinting at earlier, not to mention some Australian initiatives in online therapy through Mood Gym, invented at the ANU, or a program like the Brave program to deal with anxiety in kids, all evidence-based and brilliant. So we love that. But there's a time and place for all of those things. What we need to recognise is that many teachers, when I wrote my report, were saying, Michael, we're sick and tired of teaching from the back of the class just to make sure that people haven't got their mobile phones out. It was so disruptive. And I think it's so courageous of these various education ministers across our country to have taken the stance, risked a little bit of unpopularity and made the legislation. And we need more leadership like that.
Okay. Michael, good to have your time. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Michael Carr-Grigg, a psychologist and who's done work on phones. What do you make of this, Johan? I mean, actually, Paul's on the line from Townsville too. G'day, Paul.
Yeah, g'day.
Hey, Paul.
How are you?
I'm good.
Johan?
Hey, Paul. How you doing?
Yeah, good, mate. Listen, I'm retired now, but I used to be a university lecturer.
Yep.
And I'd be in a lecture hall with maybe 300 students or something. And believe it or not, you could tell when they weren't paying attention because they were on their mobile devices. Because the glow would be up, the glow of their devices, and you could see their heads down talking on it. And I thought, yeah, okay, they're not listening. And then when we'd get into a tutorial situation where we might have say 25, 30 students in the room, some of them would still be looking at their mobile devices. And in that situation, I could call them out pretty easily. And then I thought, well, okay, if we're getting younger students that are more, au fait with electronic devices. And so I found some programs online and used them where in our tutorials, they could, enter the answers and have them displayed, etc. And that worked to a limited effect.
It's really interesting, Paul, because there's quite a lot of research on what you're talking about. So there's loads of studies where, for example, they get a load of students listening to a lecture. They split them into three groups. First group doesn't get any text messages, has their phones and tech off. Second group can receive 4 messages. The third group can receive 8 messages. And then afterwards, they give them a test on the stuff in the lecture. And the kids who got no messages do drastically better. And the more messages you got, the worse you did. But I think there's a really important thing as well here about, because it's easy to fall into, and this is initially how I thought about this, to fall into a debate where it seems like, oh, are we pro-tech or are we anti-tech, right?
Yeah.
And I think often when we think like that, which, by the way, is how big tech want us to think about this debate. You feel a bit fatalistic because you're a bit like, well, I'm not going to give up my phone and my laptop. I'm not going to join the Amish. I guess I must be pro-tech, right? The debate isn't, are you pro-tech or anti-tech? We're all pro-tech. We all like some aspects of technology. The question is, what tech do we want, designed for what purposes, working in whose interest?
But we don't get to choose that, do we? This is the thing. It's chosen for us. I mean,
this is what's crucial. Yeah. I think that's true at the moment, but it doesn't have to be that way. Mm. I can explain more if you like.
Yeah. No, I'd like you to. But can we talk about Facebook, for example? We've done programs on this in the past. There have been quite a number of studies, actually, which show that Facebook generally makes people unhappy. In fact, Facebook themselves did a study which showed this, which they didn't publicise much.
We only know because it got leaked.
It got leaked, exactly. The elephant in the room in social media is Facebook. Perhaps these days, and it's Instagram functions. Maybe these things always change. What do you think about social media?
So I spent a lot of time in Silicon Valley interviewing people who designed key aspects of social media, right? And it was so fascinating talking to them because I actually was left with a much more complicated picture of what's going on and actually a much more hopeful picture about what we can do about it. So they explained to me, anyone listening, please don't, but if you open Facebook, TikTok, Twitter, Instagram now, those companies immediately start to make money out of you in 2 ways. The first way is really obvious. You see ads. Okay, everyone listening knows how that works. Mm-hmm. Second way is much more important. Everything that you do on these apps is everything you say, all the things you like,
it's all captured,
are scanned and sorted by their artificial intelligence algorithms to figure out what the weaknesses in your attention are, what will keep you scrolling, right? Mm. Different people have different weaknesses. And the reason for that is really simple. Every time you pick up your phone and open that app, they start to make money because you see more ads and they learn more about you. The longer you scroll, the more money they make. Every time you close the app, their revenue stream disappears. The same for your kids. Every time they open it, every time they open the app, the companies start to make money. Mm. The longer they scroll, the more money they make. Every time they close it, the revenue stream disappears. So all of this AI, all of this, these algorithms, all of this genius in Silicon Valley is geared towards one thing, figuring out how do we get you and your kids to open your phones, open your apps, and scroll as long as possible. That's it, right? That's what they care about. The head of KFC, all he cares about in his professional capacity is how many times did you go to KFC today and how big was the bucket you bought? All they care about is maximizing what they call engagement, right? We know this, like you mentioned, from the leaked documents. But the really important thing to understand is that social media doesn't have to work like that. That business model is not inherent to the technology we have. That's just one way of doing it. The way Dr. James Williams, who I mentioned before, put it to me, the axe existed for 1.4 million years before anyone said, guys, should we put a handle on this thing? The entire internet has existed for less than 10,000 days. Mm. We can change the way it works in very practical ways.
Well, can we? I mean, it's controlled by the largest corporations this world has ever seen. When you say we can change it, we have got nothing to do with it, have we? I mean, Facebook and its iterations and Apple and its iterations are the largest companies the world has ever seen.
This might sound odd, but when people say this to me, and I've had that thought myself, there are moments when you think, oh God, are we stuck in the matrix here? Mm. I think about my grandmothers. So I loved my grandmothers. I was very close and I was raised by my mother's mother because my mother was ill when I was a kid. Mm. When my grandmothers were the age I am now, I'm 43, it was 1962. One of them was a working class Scottish woman and the other was a Swiss woman living on the side of a mountain in a wooden hut. Neither of my grandmothers were allowed to have bank accounts because they were married women. Mm. It was legal for their husbands to rape them, as it was legal everywhere in the world for men to rape their wives. Mm. In practice, it was legal for men to beat the shit out of them because the police never did anything about it. Mm. And my Swiss grandmother wasn't even allowed to vote. Right. Mm. So I think about their lives and then I think about my niece's life, which I don't want to underestimate. We've got a lot further to go for women. But it's incalculably different. Even the craziest misogynist wouldn't say she shouldn't be allowed to have a bank account. It should be legal for men to rape her. She shouldn't be allowed to vote, right? Mm-hmm. So when I get pessimistic and think exactly what you said, and I understand the thought, I feel it myself at times, God, these forces we're up against are really powerful. They're not a hundredth as powerful as men were in 1962 when my grandmothers were the age I am now, right? Mm-hmm. Men controlled literally every institution of power in the whole world, every country, almost every company, every army, every police force. And what happened is ordinary women just said, you know what, we're not taking this anymore. And they fought back and extraordinary things changed. In the same way, obviously there's differences, but in a similar way, I think what we need to do is stop blaming ourselves for our attention problems, right? Mm-hmm. And this is only one of the 12 factors that I write about in Stolen Focus, but it's obviously a crucially important one, which is stop blaming ourselves. You're not weak. I'm not weak. Your kids aren't weak. We need to stop only asking for small changes. You know, we're not medieval peasants begging at the court of King Zuckerberg for a few little crumbs of attention from his table. No, we are the free citizens of democracies, and we should own our own minds.
We are the free serfs controlled by the great landlords of Facebook and Apple.
Well, let's think about some of the things we can demand from them. And I'll give you an example in the history of Australia, where I think a similar fight was fought and won. Mm. So I talked to lots of people in Silicon Valley saying, well, what's the solution to this aspect of the attention crisis, right? What do we do? And I'll give an example. Asa Raskin, who invented a key part of how most websites work. His dad, Jeff Raskin, invented the Apple Macintosh for Steve Jobs. Mm. He said to me, look, solution to this part is quite simple. You need to ban the current business model. You need to say that a business model based on secretly tracking and surveilling people in order to figure out the weaknesses in their attention sell them.
But is it new, though, Johan? In essence, aren't the business practices of these large technology giants the business practices of capitalists for all time? That is, they want to capture you and you to use their product as much as you can. You know, Coca-Cola doesn't want you to buy other soft drinks. They only want you to buy their soft drink. And so it goes.
I think it's an important point, but the acceleration of the sophistication of their techniques is so different. Coca-Cola placing an ad on TV where Michael Jackson sings something is just quantitatively different to Facebook knowing what you said to your mum last night, knowing everything you've ever liked over the last 10 years. I mean, look at the capacity of them to access knowledge about you is staggering. Mm. So I remember saying to Asa, let's say we did what he wanted and we banned the current business model, right? Because it took me a long time to get my head around this. Kept saying, well, what would happen the next day? Would I open Facebook and it would say, sorry, guys, we've gone fishing? Mm. He said, of course not. What would happen is they'd have to move to a different business model. And everyone listening has experience of those different business models. One of them is subscription. Mm. Everyone knows how Netflix works. You pay a small amount, you get access. The key thing about that is, then all the incentives change. At the moment, all the incentives for Facebook and these other apps is to figure out what are the weaknesses in Philip's attention, how do we hack them, how do we sell them to our real customer, the advertisers.
That's right.
But if you're the customer, if you're the subscriber, suddenly all those incentives change. Suddenly they're not thinking, how do we hack Philip and sell him to someone else? They're thinking, oh, what does Philip want? Turns out, Philip wants to meet up with his friends face-to-face because we feel better when we do that. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's design our app to enhance people meeting up offline, not doom-scrolling, for example. So that's one potential business model. Or think about another model. Before we had sewers, we had feces in the street, people got cholera. So we all paid to build the sewers together and we all own the sewers together. You own the sewers in Sydney, I own the sewers in London, right? Mm-hmm. It might be that like we own the sewage pipes together, because we don't want to get cholera. We might want to own the information pipes together because we don't want to get the equivalent of cholera for our attention, for our politics. We can talk about that. But whatever alternative business model, look, for as long as these companies make more money, the worse your attention gets, they will develop more and more sophisticated ways to do that. But we can make them go onto a different track. And I'll give you an example, if it's all right, in the history of Australia where that was done. Mm. So you'll remember, I remember from when I was a kid, the standard form of petrol used to be leaded petrol, right? And a bit before my time, people used to paint their homes with leaded paint.
Mm-hmm.
And it was discovered by scientists that exposure to lead really harms your brain, and in particular harms children's ability to focus. And obviously, if it's in petrol, gets in the air, everyone was breathing it in. So a group of ordinary mums, what we used to call housewives, here in Australia, banded together and said, why are we allowing this? Why are we allowing these companies to screw up our kids' brains? And it's important to notice what they didn't say. They didn't say, so let's ban all petrol, right? Just like none of us are saying, let's get rid of tech, right? What they said was, let's deal with the specific element in the petrol that's harming our kids' brains. And they were ridiculed. They were ignored. People said they were crazy. They fought for their kids, these mums. They fought for years. And everyone listening knows they won. We don't have leaded petrol anymore. As a result, the Centre for Disease Control says the average child is now 3 to 5 IQ points higher than they would have been had we not banned lead. Now, to me, that's a great example. For all of the 12 factors that are harming our attention that I talk about in Stolen Focus, there's two levels at which we've got to tackle them.
Mm.
I think of them as defense and offense. There are loads of things we can do to protect ourselves and our children at an individual level. I go through loads of examples in the book. I'm happy to talk about them. But we've got to also go on offense against the forces that are actually doing this to us.
I agree with that. Johan Hari's with us. His book, Stolen Focus, argues we've lost our ability to pay attention. We've lost our ability to focus on things, and it's largely tech-driven. Carol from Janelli. Hi, Carol.
Hi, how are you?
Not bad.
Hey, Carol.
Thank you for your conversation. It's great.
Cheers.
What's your question?
Everything you're talking about is just, I completely resonate with. I'm almost 40, and sort of me and my husband sort of all quite chat about this quite often, where sort of thinking about how we're going to approach this with our children, because we've got a son who's just turned 9, a daughter who's about to turn 6, thinking about. That they often ask us about, when we were little and what we would do and what TV shows we would watch and what things we would watch on our phone. It was quite funny because I told my son, well, we didn't have phones when I was little. and he was like, oh, I said, well, what did you have? I said, well, we just had a television. and our phones were stuck on the wall with a cord, and we could only walk a meter away from the phone. Mm. I guess my question is, with me and my husband sort of thinking about this quite a lot, and often seeing our attention being affected with our phones and having ourselves to, as almost 40-year-olds. With jobs and education and all that, having to, sort of have to control and be disciplined with how we use our phones.
Mm.
I guess my question is sort of, because we're growing up, my husband and myself and lots of friends of sort of from my generation were born in the 80s. We had that life and we were able to learn to focus and not have so many distractions.
So what's your question, Carol?
So I guess my question is focus and attention, is it something that's learned that you really have to sort of develop and become, make it something that's a strong quality that you're good at? Or is it something that regardless if my kids have a phone or not, like I could give them a phone now, is attention and focus something that's inherent?
I don't know. What do you think, Johan?
It's such an important question, Carol. It's something I explored a lot with the experts I interviewed for Stolen Focus.
Mm.
I'll give you an example. Remind me, I can give you some advice on things you might want to do with your kids in a minute, but what, there's someone who really helped me to understand this. If it's okay, I'll just tell her story because I think it really helps us to understand this. One of the heroes of my book, Stolen Focus, is a woman called Lenore Skenazy. Mm. So Lenore grew up in a suburb of Chicago in the 1960s. And from when she was 6 years old, she would leave her house every morning and walk to school on her own. Mm. And she'd generally bump into all the other kids who walked to school because in the mid-1960s, all children everywhere walked to school. I'm sure you did, Philip, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
There wasn't any other way to get there.
Exactly, right? And when school ended at 3 o'clock, Lenore would leave school with the other kids on their own. They'd wander around the neighborhood for a few hours, play games, and then they'd find their way home when they were hungry. By the time Lenore was a mother in the 1990s, she was living in New York by then in Queens, that was over, right? Children, you were expected to drop your kids at the school gate, wait and watch them go through the door, and then be waiting for them when they arrived, right? By 2003, only 10% of American children ever played outside without adult supervision. And then obviously in the last 2 years, it just disappeared entirely, right?
Of course, yeah.
And it turns out, Lenore learned from talking to lots of the scientists that I also talked to, that this childhood we've lost contained loads of things that are the answer to your question, Carol, right? That you develop attention, your attention gets stronger in certain environments. So when children play freely with each other, they develop, without adults standing over them enforcing the rules, they learn attention. They've got the space to find out what they find interesting, which is really important for attention. They learn how to persuade other kids to pay attention to what they think's interesting. They take turns. They learn how to pay attention to things other kids find are interesting. Crucially, they learn how to take risks. You climb the tree, you get a bit scared, but you don't die. If you don't get that feeling of competence, you're anxious all the time, that destroys your attention. Also, they run around. There's a lot of evidence. Physical exercise massively improves the ability to focus and pay attention. So all those things disappear. And Lenore was really uncomfortable with this. And at first she thought, well, the solution's obvious. I'll let my kid out to play and I'll, you know, hopefully other parents will do the same. But she quickly discovered, if you're the only parent doing that, your kid gets scared, you look like a nutter, and often actually in America, people call the police, right?
Yeah.
So Lenore did something different. It's one of the reasons why she's such a hero of mine, because she's one of those people who doesn't like problems, she likes solutions. She runs a group called Let Grow. It's letgrow.org. I recommend everyone who's got kids in their life goes to it. What Let Grow do is they go to whole schools and whole neighborhoods, and they say to everyone, they persuade everyone to give their kids increasing levels of independence that build up to playing outside. And of all the conversations I have for Stolen Focus, I think one of the most moving was with a 14-year-old boy in Long Island. It was just before COVID hit. So he'd been part of a Let Grow program for 9 months. And he was a big, strapping 14-year-old boy. And until that program had begun, he had never been allowed out of his house on his own, even to go for a run around the block, right? Then this program began. And I said, what did you do? And him and his friends, at first, they played games in the street. And then he said, I'll never forget how he said it. He said, Now we go into the woods, and he leaned forward and said, even though we don't have any cell phone reception there, we still go. And I said, oh, what do you do in the woods? And he said, oh, we built a fort, and now we're building other stuff. And it was amazing to watch this kid. Maybe this sounds over the top, but it was like watching a child come to life. I thought about how many children I know who never get that free. The only place they get to explore anything is on Fortnite. We can hardly be surprised they're so obsessed with it. But Lenore was with me that day when I was with that boy. And when he left, she said to me, think about human history. Think about all of human history, right? Young people had to go out. They had to explore. They had to take risks. They had to map the territory. They had to build things. And in the space of basically two generations, we took all of that away from them. It stunted them physically. It stunted their attention. It stunted them emotionally. And that boy, given a tiny little sliver of freedom, what did he do? He went into the woods and he built a fort, right? This is free. I would argue every school in Australia should have a Let Grow program, right?
What do you say? Well, you live in London. What would you say to parents in London, though? Parents in London wouldn't think that it's okay to let their kids run around unsupervised in London streets.
Well, there's lots of things.
Wouldn't.
There's lots of things we can do to make it easier for those parents.
A lot
parents.
Of parents would think that's just completely not safe.
Yeah. For example, my street.
And that'd actually be right.
The street I live on in London, for exactly that reason, we had a campaign and it succeeded. So now, between 3 and 5 on weekdays, traffic isn't allowed to come into our street so that kids can actually play safely in that street. So you're right, we've got to load it in parents' favour. We've got to do them. Actually, though, the risks to your child are tiny. I mean, for example, this kid, you know, the 14-year-old boy in Long Island, I said to him, why didn't your parents let you out before this? He said to me, oh, my parents are afraid of all these kidnappings, right?
That's right. I mean, they're worried about safety.
Yeah, except he lived in a part of Long Island where the olive oil shop is across the road from the French bakery, and there has literally never been a kidnapping in the entire history. Your child is significantly more likely to be hit by lightning than to be kidnapped by a stranger. Mm. And yet, if a parent said to you, I'm not going to let my kid out because I'm worried he might be hit by lightning, you'd think they were completely nuts, right? Mm. So we've got to have a realistic sense of risk. The guarantee of stunting their bodies and their minds versus a risk significantly smaller than them being hit by lightning. I think we have to weigh those things sensibly. But actually, it's not... Lenore always says, it's not arguing with parents about the statistics that does it. What does it is when they let their kid go out and he comes back a little bit sweaty and he's taken a risk and they can see him growing and they're like, that's my boy, right? Because what we're doing is we're stunting our kids. We're making them less competent because it's taking small risks and exploring that makes you competent, which makes you able to pay attention, which makes you able to think clearly.
So what are you going to do about kids and social media?
And it's all sorts of things we can do. Yeah. So, for example...
Talk about that.
Yeah. Please. So, with Carol, I would recommend what she does because she's thinking about going forward. So, again, it comes back to that. Two ways of thinking about it. Mm. Defense and offense, right? We've got to defend ourselves and our kids. We've got to take on the forces that are harming them. So... in terms of defense, I go through dozens of things in Stolen Focus. I'll give you an example of a specific one that I'd recommend Carol does. Because I know so many parents, and I've got a lot of sympathy for them, it's really hard being a parent, who are always yelling at their kids to get off their phone while staring at their own phones, right? Mm. So I would recommend Carol buy something called a K-safe. I don't get any commission from this, I promise you. You go online, a K-safe is a plastic safe. You take off the lid, you put in your phone, you put on the lid, you turn the dial at the top, and it'll lock your phone away for anything between 5 minutes and a whole day. Mm-hmm. I would recommend while your kids are still young, get in the habit, show them every day you and your husband lock your phone away for a day so you can look into each other's eyes and talk properly, right? Mm-hmm. And then when they're old enough to have phones, make that part of their day so you have at least some space. You're teaching them about the importance of attention away from technology. But also, it comes back to, I want to be really honest because I am passionately in favor of these individual changes that I advocate in Stolen Focus. They will really help Carol. They'll help lots of people like her and indeed adults who don't have kids. But at the moment, it's like someone is pouring itching powder over us all day. And then they're leaning forward and going, you know what, mate, you might want to learn how to meditate. Then you wouldn't scratch so much. And you want to go, well, screw you. I'll learn to meditate. That's really valuable. But you need to stop pouring this damn itching powder on me. Mm. We need to stop the forces that are doing this to us.
Do you think, I mean, almost every point in human history when there's been a big invention, people have said this is the end of the world. When television was invented, the same. I mean, my father never bought a television partly because he hated the idea of it. And apart from the expense, he just didn't like the idea of it. And this has always been the case when new technology has been invented. Yeah. Are we simply going through the bump at the moment?
So this is something
that social media has brought us.
This is a question I take very seriously in the book, and I thought through a lot. I would all stress again,
and that we'll learn to deal with it.
Yeah, and I stress again, these aspects of our technology are only one of the 12 factors that I write about in Stolen Focus that are harming our attention, and it's only some aspects of our technology, but. On the technology, it's a really important question. And for a time I thought, maybe this is like the scare about TV or about rap music or horror comic books. But I spent a lot of time discussing this with one of the leading experts on children's attention problems in the world, a man named Professor Joel Nigg, who's in Portland in Oregon. And he said to me that we need to think of it as more like obesity, right? Mm. So if you think about, it's really interesting, if you look at when Harold Holt drowned in, was it 1966? Mm. There's news footage of people on the beach that day. And it's really weird when you look at that footage because everyone is what we would think of as skinny or buff. Mm. Everyone, right? Mm. Look at any picture of a beach anywhere in the world in the 60s. Everyone is skinny or buff, right? Mm. And you sort of think, well, where are the obese people? Where are the overweight people? But then you look at the evidence on this. We've got very good evidence on this. There were almost no obese people in the 1960s, right? It begins to rise at the end of the 1960s. It rises and rises. And of course, in the 70s, when some people said, there are changes in the way we live, particularly the way we eat, that are making people obese. If this carries on, there'll be huge amounts of obesity. Lots of people said, oh, come on now. There's always changes. People always think the world is getting worse. In fact, they were right. If we'd listened when obesity was at 1%, if we listened when obesity was at 2%, we would have been able to prevent the situation. I don't know the figures for Australia, but I know in Britain soon, a majority of men, including me, are going to be overweight or obese, right? So you can see, I think this is obesity rose because there were really big changes in the way we live, right? The food we eat completely changed. Mm. We built cities that it's really hard to walk and bike around, and we became more stressed, which makes you want to comfort eat more. In the same way, I think the evidence is pretty clear that this isn't like rap music, where it's just like a bit of a fear. There are really big changes happening in the way we live, of which these aspects of tech are one of the 12, that are profoundly altering our relationship to attention. This is why Professor Nigg said to me, we should be asking if we live in what he called an attentional pathogenic environment, an environment that is systematically undermining our attention. But we can start to put that environment right when we understand these 12 underlying factors that are harming us.
Yeah. I think it's the topic of our times. I really do. I mean, putting climate change aside, I think it's the topic of the time.
In a funny way, I think it's related to climate change. I met Dr. Williams, who I mentioned before. He said to me, imagine you're driving somewhere and someone throws a bucket of mud over your windshield. Doesn't matter what you've got to do when you get to your destination, you've got to get that mud off your windshield, right? Mm. And I think the attention crisis is like this. Doesn't matter what you care about, whether it's climate or anything else, first thing we've got to do is get our attention right, because we're not going to be competent to do anything else if we don't.
I hear to that. Johan, fascinating to talk.
Oh, what a pleasure.
Thanks very much for your time, and enjoy your visit here.
Oh, thank you so much.
Johan Hari is the author of Stolen Focus, and it contains important messages, I think, for all of us.